Food Insecurity talks about basically people who are not able to afford food, who don't have access to food conveniently in their neighborhood, and not just any food, but specifically healthy and nutritious food and fresh produce, whether it's the fact that they don't have grocery stores near them or the ones that are near them may not sell those types of things. We hear a lot of the times that people who are living in food insecure areas or in food deserts, that can have a real impact on people's health. Everything that we kind of expected bore out, which is, you know, not always the case in reporting, but in this sense, it was pretty much across the board. And you can go on the website and you can hover over each little zip code on the map and you'll see the North Shore is struggling with this a lot more than the South Shore is. Welcome to the Staten Island Advances from the Scene, a podcast bringing you an inside look at the biggest stories on Staten Island with the reporters who cover them. I'm your host, Eric Bascom, although today I'm actually not your host. I'm switching chairs and I will be the guest on this week's podcast and joined by our producer, Jason Patteron, who will be hosting today. How's it going, Jason?
How's it going? I've been busy with that DEI panel, which if you guys haven't checked out yet, it's up on YouTube. So that basically took up all my time for the last couple weeks, so that was a nice thing that we got off the bat, and now it's back to the regularly scheduled program, right?
Yeah, and I appreciate you hopping on to host this one and ask me the questions because, you know, we've talked about this a little bit. It's hard for me to talk about my own reporting on here because we don't want to interview ourselves. It would have been a lot of editing, I think, well, on your part to go back and forth.
You could have done, like, the meme thing on Instagram, like where you have you on one right side and you on the other.
I'll just be the Spider-Man meme right, pointing back and forth at myself. And also, usually when we are talking about some of my reporting, we'll have Tom on to talk about, you know, from the opinion side of things. So I thought that it would be nice to switch things up. So I appreciate you coming on to help us out with this, taking a step in front of the lens for once.
Of course.
Yeah, let's get into it.
All right, just the term food insecurity. What is that? What are we talking about?
Yeah, so food insecurity is, it's one of the new projects that I'm working on here at The Advance, and it talks about basically people who are not able to afford food, who don't have access to food conveniently in their neighborhood, and not just any food, but specifically healthy and nutritious food and fresh produce is something that we see is a big obstacle for people who are living in certain parts of the borough, whether it's the fact that they don't have grocery stores near them or the ones that are near them may not sell those types of things, or the bigger ones where they might get better prices or a little further away and they don't have cars, so there's some difficulties with that. And so that's kind of what we're working with right now. I've launched this new series. It's called Health and Hunger on Staten Island, and this is something that we really have been thinking about doing for a long time here at The Advance. So some of our readers might remember back in 2020-2021, we launched this series called The Disparity Project, which was looking at differences in resources between different parts of the island, so the North Shore compared to the South Shore and Mid-Island. And we, at that time, focused really specifically on education. Annalise Knutson did a lot of that reporting. And then also on housing, which Giovanni Alves and Paul Liotta did a lot of that. But food was something that we didn't really touch on at the time, but was something that our editors had always been really hot on, that issue. So once I moved into this new role a few months ago as the data investigative reporter here, this felt like kind of a natural step for something that we could really dig into and try and see if the things that people expect and the things that, you know, you've hear about for a long time, if the data really bears that out. So it's been really interesting and really cool to work on.
Where did you get the idea from? Was it just driving by on a Tuesday and seeing a giant line?
The idea for it really does date back years. They've been trying to get us to do something on this for a long time, but we haven't really had someone dedicated to this type of reporting in this way. And so now that I am really focused in on data and I'm able to do a little bit more long form work, and instead of, you know, maybe churning out articles like quick hits every day, I'm able to kind of dig into things. And these articles, we have three out so far in the series, and I've been working on this for, I would say, at least 2 months now. So that really gives me the opportunity to do the kind of reporting that I think can be a little more impactful and dig a little deeper and below the surface. So it was really just, like I said, something that we've been interested in for a long time. And now that we have the time and the resources to do it, I was excited. And this was really one of the first things I pitched when I got into the new role.
So I'm guessing you're combing through a lot of data, a lot of different sources. What kind of data were you looking at? What were you finding from these things?
A lot of it is coming from the census, from their 2022 American Community Survey, which is the most recent. Obviously, you know, the actual census is only every 10 years, so it's harder to use that, but they do yearly updates on certain topics. So we've been using a lot of that and then matching that data to health data that's available from the CDC. We hear a lot of the times that people who are living in food insecure areas or in food deserts, as we term them, which we'll talk a little bit more about later, that can have a real impact on people's health. That's not really surprising, right? And so we're going through data and I'm looking at areas where people are struggling to afford food, areas where people are reliant on SNAP benefits or food stamps, as some people refer to them, to get food. And then it's like, okay, well, these are the areas on Staten Island where most people are struggling to get food. So what does the health data look like in those areas? And how does that compare to areas where it's not as big of an issue? So we were looking through CDC data, through census data, and basically we found kind of what we expected to, which is that the people who are living in areas where people are more reliant on SNAP, who are more reliant on the food pantries, those people have worse health outcomes in terms of obesity and diabetes and high blood pressure and all those sorts of things. That was kind of the basis for it. That was sort of the first step. And that has kind of led us into a lot of the other reporting that I've done.
I know, like, I've seen some of these reports and sometimes it's just a whole block of things. And how do you keep that palatable?
Yeah.
No better lack of terms.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I always say that that's one of our biggest jobs as a reporter is to take these complex, nuanced issues and boil them down and present them in a way that the public can easily understand and is more consumable or palatable for them. So the big thing that I have been focusing on, which I think has been really helpful, has been creating sort of graphics or interactive maps in this case that really spell out the issue, because it's one thing if you're reading the article and says, well, in the North Shore, it's like this, in the South Shore, it's like this. Eventually, your eyes just glaze over.
Right.
And so what I've done is, again, in my new role, trying to focus more on data, I've created some maps, which you can find on our website. They're included in pretty much every article in the series so far, which breaks down Staten Island by zip code. It's a big map of Staten Island, and then it's interactive. So when you hover over different areas, it will show you the statistics that I was kind of outlining earlier. So when you look along the North Shore, you're going to see that the people there are higher percentages of households who are relying on SNAP benefits, and then they are also going to have higher rates of people with those aforementioned conditions. So it's obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, all of things that can lead to some serious health complications further down the line. And then when you go to the South Shore and you hover over those, you see much lower percentages of people who are doing that. And so what I've seen, let's look at some of the data.
Was it really that black and white?
You know what? It really was. And that's one thing that people often say, you know, the North Shore is this and the South Shore is that. And, you know, Mid-Island is somewhere in between. And it's like, okay, that seems like an overgeneralization. But in many cases, that actually did kind of turn out to be the case. And so I had seen basically that on the North Shore in those zip codes, 10301, 302, 303, 304, and 310, that the residents there, there's a higher percentage living below the poverty line. There is a higher percentage who are relying on food stamps or SNAP benefits. And then those also have those higher rates of diseases. So you have the percentage of people that are struggling with these things on the North Shore. In those zip codes, the amount that are obese range from 35% to 38%. On the South Shore, it's 31.1 to 31.6. On the North Shore, diabetes is from 12.4% to 13.9%. On the South Shore, it's only 8.8 to 9.8 in those zip codes. High blood pressure, same thing. So basically, everything that we kind of expected bore out, which is, you know, not always the case in reporting, but in this sense, it was pretty much across the board. And you can go on the website and you can hover over each little zip code on the map and you'll see the North Shore is struggling with this a lot more than the South Shore is.
I know you had a line in there. A lot of times people associate a food shortage as not having food, mm-hmm. but in these cases, these people are selecting food that may be on the unhealthy side because that's what's affordable.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And I had a really good quote. Let me see if I can find it from one of the doctors that I spoke to. I spoke with a ton of people from Staten Island University Hospital, from Rumsey, from some various food pantries that we'll talk about a little bit more. They told me that when you hear food insecurity, you assume that these people don't have any food, right? So you would think that that would lead more towards malnutrition or the fact that people would be skinnier and struggling with those types of things. But what actually happens is that because these people are struggling financially and because they don't have access, immediate access to this fresh produce in their neighborhoods, they're eating processed foods, alternatives that are far less nutritious from them. So people who are food insecure actually tend to struggle more with obesity than they would a malnutrition. And then that is what then leads into some of these other things. So I thought that that was a really interesting part of it, is the fact that, you know, it's not necessarily that these people don't have food, it's that they can't afford the right foods, or they don't have access to the right foods because they don't have a car, they can't drive to the supermarket. That's another thing that we had heard a lot about, which we'll talk a little bit more when we get to the kind of food desert specific aspect of this. But yeah, I thought that was very interesting. One of the things they said to me was, well, are you going to spend $30 on fresh produce, or can you spend $5 on enough ramen to feed you for the week, or you and your family, you know? So a lot of times people are forced to make those choices as a result. And that's how you kind of end up seeing these poorer health outcomes as a result.
Well, I think we all see it, like when we all went to college and we were living off a budget.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, you don't think about it like 10, 12 years later, you know, was there anything else that the doctors brought up that maybe surprised you or anything like that?
It was really what I was expecting for the most part in terms of what the health outcomes would look like as a result of it. And they try and help these types of patients. Whenever people come into these hospitals and they have some sort of weight-related ailments, one of the first things they ask is, what does your food situation look like? What are you eating in your diet? And then they'll work with their patients and say, okay, well, I know that food is tough to come by, or healthier foods and fresh produce, but here are some different ways that you can cost-effectively adjust your budget. And that's actually something that a future story that I'm going to have coming out of this. But basically, they're launching different initiatives and different programs to try and educate people. I know one of the hospitals, I'm forgetting which one off the top of my head, is working with some schools. They're going to the schools and they're talking to kids, trying to get to them young and say, like, hey, this is what your meals should look like. They actually even give out cost-effective cookbooks for meals that would be healthier and won't break the bank, right? And so there's a lot going on to try and address this issue at so many different levels. And I think that that's one of the things that really stuck out to me in this reporting, is that it's just such a multifaceted issue that there are just so many different things to tackle from it. But the healthcare professionals are really just saying, you know, what we expected them to say, that they know it's hard for these people to access this fresh produce, but, you know, they're trying to figure out different ways to make it cost effective for them, make it convenient for them. And so that, you know, that will hopefully be then reflective in the health outcomes.
Do you think there's a correlation, low income, maybe because they're going from job to job, maybe they don't have time to cook? Maybe that's a contributing factor to, okay, well, we'll just go get McDonald's. We'll just go get takeout.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that that's a huge aspect of it as well. And something that we're also planning to dig into a little bit further down the line with this project is that these type of people are often working two jobs. Like you said, they often have family at home, children to take care of or whatever it might be. So it can be extremely difficult for people who are struggling, living paycheck to paycheck, working multiple jobs. Even people who aren't necessarily struggling financially. I mean,
like
you see how, yeah, I was just going to say, you see how hard we're working. Sometimes, you know, we're so busy, we're running back and forth. You run downstairs and grab a slice of pizza and just right. For that, right? I mean, it'd be better if I could make a salad at home and bring it with me, but I'm running out the door. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And so a lot of it is also convenient. That is definitely a factor at play here as well, especially for the people who are working multiple jobs.
You talk about convenience. Your second article in there has to do with food pantries, which is kind of helping make it convenient, I suppose, for some of these people that don't have immediate access or the means to fresh produce, things like that.
This is one thing that actually kind of surprised me a little bit when I started to dig into it more for the article, is I did not realize the sheer number of food pantries that are on Staten Island. And so I've been working with some people from the Staten Island Hunger Task Force, which is a coalition of various different community organizations who all kind of, they meet monthly and they work together to try and figure out different ways to feed hungry Staten Islanders. Really, that's kind of their main mission. And so if you go to their website, and I've linked to this in my reporting, I also have the list in there as well, but they have this whole big list and map of every single food pantry on Staten Island. When I was going through it, and I was like, oh my God, there's over 50 food pantries. And that's not even including the mobile units, which is they fill trucks up, they go park outside different parks or apartment complexes or whatever it might be. And so there are so many of these going on. And I spoke to a few of them. One of them that really stood out to me is at the JCC, their food pantry, they told me that they serve 20,000 people a year, which then you do the math and break it down, it's like over 1,000 people per month who are getting food.
It's also how many people on Staten Island, and then between all those things, you know, I'm sure some of them repeat, but...
Yeah, no, it's at least 1,000 unique families there. And then I went to Port Richmond, I was standing outside El Centro de la Migrante, and they have a weekly food pantry. The line was down the block. Right. It was almost wrapped around the corner. There were 200 plus people, I would say, and they say they usually average around 200 to 250 families per week who are there. And these food pantries, I mean, they're truly doing the Lord's work in many senses in terms of this is a lot of times the only fresh produce that these families are able to obtain, right? So they will go to the corner store or the bodega or maybe even a smaller grocery store in their neighborhood to get the essentials and some of those cheaper processed foods that we were talking about to kind of be the foundation of your meal. And then they go to these places and they're able to get broccoli and pineapple, and they've done sweet potatoes and carrots and all of these sorts of things. And a lot of times this is, again, the only time that these people are able to receive that type of stuff. And it's clear that the need is there. And just by the fact that, again, there's over 50 pantries and each of them tells me that they're, you know, handling hundreds of people per week. And so when you do that and you extrapolate it out, I mean, there are thousands and thousands of Staten Islanders who are really, really struggling with this. And if you don't drive past a food pantry and see the line, you might not realize that's something that I've also talked to people a lot about, and they've kind of brought up is that you don't realize the extent of food insecurity. This is reflected in the headline of my first article, which is that one of the biggest health concerns facing Staten Island is hiding in plain sight. If you are not someone personally affected by this or someone who is volunteering, you know, to help these people, you might not even know that this exists, which is another reason why we thought that this was such an important topic.
I noticed you mentioned the thing with supermarkets. I know one of them, you had a map and you had like all the major supermarkets and you could see there's definitely areas where it's missed. Growing up here, I was right down the block from one, so it was out of mind.
Yeah.
And then now when I'm driving around, I'll see those lines. Those lines are immense. They go wrap around the block, and you see all these people with boxes, and it really puts like a human face to these things. Things you might not think about if you happen to live in proximity to these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that was the third article in the series that published earlier this week. And this is focused on that food desert term that we talked about earlier.
Which I had to look up just to make sure it was actually a word.
Yeah, no, it is. It's
it
a term.
It was actually in Webster's dictionary, but so is bootylicious. So
that's fair. No, this is something that is used by the federal government, by the USDA, by all of these people to describe these areas. And so it's basically talking about geographic areas where residents have limited access to fresh and affordable produce due to a lack of easily accessible supermarkets. So those are some of the kind of key words in there that I highlighted, because I think when we first thought of this as a topic for this series, it was like, well, there's not going to be anything on the North Shore. There's going to be no supermarkets. And then, you know, in Mid-Island and South Shore, there's going to be a ton of them. And that's not exactly what the map showed. And so then in my discussions with people, it's like, yes, okay, there might be some supermarkets located in those areas along the North Shore. But the issue is that the people who are living there, a lot of them don't have access to cars. A lot of them are living in poverty. So they can't necessarily afford that produce or even make their way to those grocery stores. So the food desert, it's not necessarily that there's nothing anywhere nearby. It's that you're struggling to get there. Some of these people have to take two or three buses just to get to a grocery store. And then who wants to lug their groceries
the
bus?
I think about it with my mom too. Like she has to be able to carry everything. It's still down the block, but she has to be able to carry it. So without help, she has to get whatever she can and fit it within two bags that she can easily carry.
Exactly. And so I looked at the United States Department of Agriculture has what they now call a food access research atlas. It used to be called the Food Desert Locator, which was a lot more straightforward and in line with what we were looking for. But you can go on there, you can zoom in on different zip codes, different areas, and see where are people struggling with this issue. So I have a map in one of the stories from this food access research atlas, which shows basically a couple spots along the North Shore, multiple spots really, where people are not only living in poverty, but then also don't have access to a car, and the grocery stores are more than a mile or half a mile away from them. And so again, in that area on the North Shore, between 13 and 18% are living in poverty, and between 22 and 26% don't have a car, right? Then you go to the South Shore, It's only between 4.5% and 7% in poverty, and only between 6% and 8% that don't have a car. So, I mean, there's triple as many people who don't have a car. There's pretty much twice as many who are living in poverty. And so that's what's affecting this food desert situation as well. It's not that there are no grocery stores there or no major supermarkets. It's that these people can't get, and I mean, we all know about Staten Island's bus network. I was right. The transportation reporter for years. So a place could be a mile away from you, and it could take 2 or 3 buses just to zigzag right. your way across and get there. And so I think that that is something that really stood out to me, is that it wasn't exactly what we were expecting in terms of the supermarket map. But then once you dig a little deeper, you understand that it's not just about having them there. It's about being able to get to the store and being able to afford this produce that kind of dictates what is and isn't a food desert.
Okay, so what's being done currently about these food deserts? What can be done? What are we looking at?
Yeah, so this is another really complicated one. And so there's a couple different ways that I want to talk about this. So there's the short-term stopgap measures or solutions, and then there's, you know, what can be done long-term, right? And so in the short-term, you see basically, I mean, what we were talking about earlier with the food pantries in terms of community organizations trying to fill those gaps and get fresh produce to people who are living in neighborhoods where they may not be able to access it on their own. But then you also have other initiatives there's one that I focus on in the first article in the series. It's called the Clementine Collective. And this is an initiative of Health for Youths, which is a local nonprofit who works on various food insecurity issues. And so the Clementine Collective is basically, they were like, okay, a lot of these corner stores and bodegas where people in these neighborhoods are forced to shop because they can't get to the supermarket, they don't sell any fresh fruit, any fresh vegetables, and in a lot of cases, because people in the neighborhoods can't afford to buy them, they spoil quickly, and so are the businesses going to end up losing money on it? So they don't have that available. So what the Clementine Collective does is they set up these little kiosks outside of the corner store or the bodegas, and they stock them with fresh fruits and vegetables rotated based on whatever is currently in season. And they're free, and they just sit there. And then people in the neighborhoods, when they walk by, they go to the bodega, they go to the store, they could grab a couple sweet potatoes, they could grab some bananas.
So it's kind of like what you see in the city with like the outdoor.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like a little kiosk. And this is all free. And this is, you know, available to the public. They started with just one stand. I think it was on Jersey Street at one of the markets there. And they have now expanded it into 15 different locations on Staten Island. If you go on their website, which I believe I linked to in one of the articles, you can take a look at where they're currently available. And so this is something that they were trying to do, you know, again, just give back to the community and help them in ways and make these things more readily available to them and put them in the places where the people are going, right? If the people are going to have to do their shopping at the corner store or the bodega, then you want to make this available there. And so that's kind of a short-term thing that they're doing. They're also working with these store owners to say, hey, look, there is a demand for this. People are taking these. You should try and start selling these here. So that is kind of the next step there. Then the other part is trying to get, honestly, just more supermarkets in these areas and put them closer to major thoroughfares where people, you know, you could take one bus and get there, or you can walk from your house or whatever. And so the example that I use in our articles is on Richmond Terrace, because that's something that the city has been looking at for a while. If you drive along Richmond Terrace, I mean, you see the stack of salt and you see the old manufacturing stuff and you see some auto body shops and all of that kind of stuff. But there's not really any resources or amenities, I guess. There's no supermarkets. There's not really many restaurants. There's nothing like that. And so the city has been looking at that, and they've been, you know, talking about ways to kind of reimagine it, is the phrase they're using. But a lot of it, and what we're hearing from the community, is that they want zoning changes there. They want them to change the zoning so that people can build supermarkets on that location. I mean, there's plenty of buses that go right down Richmond Terrace. So you put a supermarket there, you know, get the necessary zoning changes, that probably makes things easier for a lot of people. Where the issue then comes in is that even if they do change the zoning, you can't necessarily force a big supermarket chain to right. put something in that location. So then how do you incentivize those types of supermarkets, whether it's through, you know, policy or tax incentives or whatever, to build up in these locations where it's most needed? And one of the doctors I spoke to actually had this quote that really jumped out to me. They live somewhere on the North Shore. It was Stapleton or Tompkinsville or something like that. And she was saying, you know, I live in this area. There's really nothing over there. And there was this huge vacant plaza, and I was really excited that they were going to put a big supermarket there. But instead, they put a Taco Bell. Huh. So, I mean, that's kind of exactly what we're talking about here, is that, you know, not only are we not putting in supermarkets where, you know, these fast food restaurants kind of swoop in and they're like, well, these areas are, you know, reliant on fast food and all of these sorts of things. But they're just exacerbating the existing issues. And so that becomes its own challenge. Even if you do get the zoning that allows for the supermarkets to be built there, then you need to convince ShopRite, Stop and Shop, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, whoever it is, to go build something there. And are they going to want to do that because there's lower income in the neighborhood, and do they feel like they'll make as much money and all of this kind of stuff? And so then you get into, do they need to have tax incentives and this and that? And so it's just such a complicated issue, which is why I think that as we try and kind of figure out those long-term things that we have with the food pantry and the Clementine Collective in the short term are so valuable to those residents.
But aren't the food pantries, you know, at least helped in part by government money? Isn't it one of those things where, like, you could just move that money to a different initiative?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, a lot of them definitely are funded because, you know, these are being run by nonprofits. Some of them are by religious organizations, so those are, you know, pretty much purely off donations. But some of them definitely are funded with government money. And so that is one way that you could maybe reallocate. I would say that would be maybe a little dangerous, just in that even if we do get the supermarkets built there, you probably still need the pantries for certain people who are struggling even more mightily financially. But yeah, there's definitely ways that can be done. I mean, we look at the state budget's going to pass soon, and, you know, the billions of dollars that are in that, and the city budget's the same way, and all of this kind of stuff. There's money out there. There's ways for them to do this. Whether the political will is there is really more of the question.
Right. And in this series, what else are we looking at?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a lot of what we've actually touched on some of it so far, but other things, I'm going to be hopefully interviewing some of the volunteers who are working at these food pantry events, why they do what they do, what it's like, what they hear from the residents. And so that one should be interesting. We're trying to get some people, and if anyone listening is interested in chatting with us, we're trying to get some people who are actually struggling with these issues to talk to us about their experiences, but it's a little difficult, right? I mean, it's a lot of people don't want to necessarily go in the newspaper and say, hey, I can't afford to feed my family, right? It could be embarrassing for some people, even though it shouldn't be, because as we said, thousands and thousands of people just here on Staten Island are dealing with this. So it's been a little bit more difficult in that regard, but definitely something we want to look into. And we also are going to be looking at kind of the rates of food insecurity among youth, which I think is an important topic. Youth is would be one end of it. And then senior citizens. Those are two people who struggle with this on a level that we don't necessarily always, I think we often think of the families, right? Or the moms of, you know, with three kids in line or whatever. But I guess the kids are the aspect of it that sometimes get forgotten. And so multiple schools on Staten Island have their own food pantries. I know Port Richmond has one. We had an article recently about one of the charter schools actually here at Corporate Commons is getting a food pantry. And so these kinds of things allow the students to, you know, after class, one day a week, go in there, kind of shop around, see what they might need for their family and bring things home. And things like that are so valuable because some of the people, the experts that I've spoken to, they talk about, you know, kids with struggling with food insecurity, it kind of snowballs on them, right? You go to school and you're hungry, and then you're hungry and you're irritable and you can't concentrate. Then it's, you know, you struggle with your performance in school, and then that leads to struggling to gain higher education, and then struggling to find a profession in your desired field, and all of these sorts of things. So I think the child aspect of it is really interesting and something we'll be looking at. And then senior citizens are also a huge group that relies on those SNAP benefits that we were talking about earlier, or food stamps. I think a lot of people only think of poor people living in affordable housing as the people who are relying on that and relying on government benefits. But a lot of it is older people who are on fixed incomes. And so I think when you get to those senior citizens as well, we're also talking about people that if they're in one of these food desert areas, if you're 80 years old, you can't be taking the bus to the grocery store and lugging that stuff back. So this is impacting them even more so than, you know, maybe some younger adults or other middle-aged adults, just because of the way that their lack of mobility or, you know, lack of accessibility to these stores. And so I think that focusing on the different age ranges is something that our readers should definitely be looking out for.
No, and I know firsthand because I deal with it with my kids. Basically, my daughter only eats chicken nuggets and mac and cheese. School is the only place actually right now that she is offered a variety. So what's interesting is I see she finishes her food over there. but then when she comes home, I'll make her broccoli. I'll make her, and she's like, I want chicken nuggets.
Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, like, I think getting them in the habit of getting those nutrients early, because it becomes a snowball effect. I mean, I don't want her in high school and, you know, still eating chicken nuggets and
no,
and
absolutely,
like I did.
Yeah, well, I was gonna say, got to break that generational those generational habits.
Ends now.
Yeah. But yeah, so there's a lot to come on this. We've got three articles out so far, so I would definitely encourage anyone who has not checked them out yet to go read those. And if you are interested in talking to me either about your personal experience or some of the work that you do to try and address these issues, please reach out. You can find my email address on any of the articles on our website, but you know, it's also tbascom@siadvance.com. So there's that, and I'd love to hear from some people.
And I think a good point to add is also that it doesn't necessarily have to be just the thought that you couldn't afford it, because people just, like I do, like I don't necessarily make the healthiest decision. So like a lot of these things also factors in when it comes to convenience. So like you don't always have to think, okay, I'm poor, I'm desolate, or I'm not able to
right.
provide for
but
my
just
family.
In terms of how diet impacts health yes. outcomes, I think that is a huge part of this story. And that was really the focus of the first article. And we've kind of been branching out into some different directions from there. But yeah, it's a great point. It's not just about people who can't afford food, people who can't access food. It's about the way that your diet impacts your health in a way that, you know, most people know, but I don't know that they fully understand.
Right. I mean, you wait for it to show in the mirror, but it might not necessarily be there.
No, so. That's true. It's not really, that's not always reflective, because there are people who appear to be in great health, but the diet that they're eating, it may be keeping them thin, potentially, right? But it's not giving them those necessary nutrients that you get when you're eating fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, fresh, you know, meats and all of that kind of stuff. So if you're just eating frozen processed food, you might think you're healthy and you might not be. So
right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'll let you wrap this up because that's technically your spot.
Yeah, that's true. Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Staten Island Advances from the Scene. Thank you, Jason, for hopping on the mic today. And if you like what you've heard, please make sure to rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and visit silive.com for the latest on all these stories and more. Thank you for supporting local journalism.